Well, this is Karen Cataline, and we continue a new era here on the Alan Nathan Show with the Alan Nathan All-Stars in the news of the untimely passing of Alan Nathan. And it is in his memory and honor that we continue the show. And I'm Karen Cataline, and I have often done Mondays, and we'll probably continue doing that. And it'll be my honor to do so. We welcome Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies. His articles have appeared in outlets such as the Washington Post, the New York Times. His most recent publication is Open Immigration, Yay or Nay, co-authored with Alex Norosta at the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, in case you wanted to know. Mark Krikorian joins us right now on the Alan Nathan Show and the Alan Nathan All-Stars.
Howdy. So does that make me an all-star too as a guest?
Oh, absolutely. You are. You know, we have a lot to talk about with immigration enforcement in Chicago. Interestingly, if you wrote a book on immigration, yay or nay, and the Cato Institute, well, libertarians have been notoriously open borders. Could you speak to that? Because look at what we got today, you know, as a result of completely open borders.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the libertarians have always been for that. But
yeah,
the way I look at it is that they, in the old days, I'm talking like 40, 50 years ago, the main issues in politics were things where libertarians and conservatives agreed, like the size of government, taxes, regulation, and all that stuff. They haven't changed their thoughts on that. But the most important issues now are what one writer calls the national question, sovereignty, borders, immigration, that sort of thing. And on those issues, the libertarians are part of the left's coalition. So they're becoming an eccentric part of the left-wing alliance when they used to be an eccentric part of the right-wing alliance.
So interesting. I mean, we've had, what was it, the Koch brothers. One of them is
right.
Still with us. I used to have those arguments with libertarians and say, well, maybe it could work if we didn't have a massive and robust welfare state. But if you combine the welfare state with open immigration, open borders, how is that in any way either constitutional or free market?
Yeah, I mean, in that regard, people often quote Milton Friedman, the libertarian economist, who said you can't have open immigration and a welfare
yes.
state.
Yes.
The thing is, the libertarian response is, yes, that's true, so we have to get rid of the welfare state. My response is, okay, do that and then give me a call. You know, it's not happening. And, you know,
excellent.
I'm not even sure we would want it to happen. At least, I mean, look, I'm a conservative. Oh. I want a system of social provision for the poor to be tightly run, not lead to dependency, all of that stuff. But we're going to have something like that. We're not going to let people die on the steps of the emergency room. You know, that's
we never
just, that
have.
Kind of thing isn't happening. Right.
We never will. And it's a fascinating argument to preface. The argument you're here to talk about is not so much of an argument. I'm dying to know more about what's happening in Chicago in particular with this just comical fellow, not because he is overweight, but because he is absolutely irrational, J.D. Pritzker, who thinks he's going to run for president. What's going on with immigration enforcement in Chicago? What do we need to know?
Chicago and the county it's in, Cook County, and the state it's in, Illinois, are all sanctuaries for illegal aliens. And what that means is the local law enforcement is not allowed to cooperate in any way with immigration enforcement. And by that, I do not mean that they're not allowed to go around asking people for their green cards. ICE doesn't want local police doing that. What they want is that when local police arrest people for their own reasons, you know, they're drug dealers, they're drunk drivers, they're wife beaters, whatever it is, that when they're fingerprinted, and those fingerprints go to DHS, which they do now, as well as the FBI, that if they're illegal, that they hold on to them until ICE can come and get them. That's all ICE wants. And these jurisdictions won't do that. They literally release onto the street criminals who are deportable and who could be deported and removed from the community, which would benefit everybody, especially immigrant communities, because that's where most of these dirtbags live. And yet they won't do it. And so I was actually, we did a podcast on this, our current podcast at CIS.org. You can find it there and anywhere else. But I interviewed one of our analysts who was just in the Chicago area talking to law enforcement people. And I was just there last week speaking at a university and went down and visited, or not visited, got near the ICE detention center outside Chicago where all of the ruckus has been. There have been riots and stuff there. There wasn't much going on. It was the middle of the day. And there were several old people walking around with signs. And there was one joker with an inflatable rubber duck costume. It was kind of absurd. But what's happening is that the city government, the mayor, Brandon Johnson, and the governor that you referred to, J.B. Pritzker, who is not going to be president, regardless of what he thinks, are
let's run him.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I mean, maybe he can be Kamala's.
No, let's run him. Yeah. I mean, I think Republicans are looking at that and going, okay, we'll take that.
Yeah. And so what they're basically doing is interfering with ICE. In fact, recently there was an incident that the ICE officers, it was in the city of Chicago, they were threatened by a mob, and the local in the Chicago Police Department, not the chief, but like the local guy who was answerable on that shift, told the Chicago cops to stand down and not protect the ICE agents from the physical threats they were facing. That's why the president has talked about sending National Guard and other federal assets to not to arrest people, but to protect federal facilities and protect federal officers.
Yeah. And let's stick with Illinois and Chicago for a moment. It's not as if Chicago doesn't have an enormously historic history, that's redundant, of rioting and violence and mob history. It's like a veritable treasure trove of unrest that we've had. And now there's this governor and mayor who are actually proud to act like Baghdad Bobs and say, there is no violence in Chicago.
Right. I mean, it's kind of funny because, I mean, it's funny in a dark way.
Terrifyingly funny.
Yeah.
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 But, you know, if they go a weekend without, you know, some two-digit number of shootings, it's a big deal, you know. So it really is irrational, and irrational both in the sense of, you know, kind of crazy, but also sub-rational. In other words, they're not doing this. I don't think they're really doing this, even Pritzker, for specific political objectives or with some kind of strategy in mind. They just think that immigration enforcement is evil in itself, especially if the bad orange man in Washington is ordering it. But even if it wasn't him, it's evil. It's like Jim Crow. And so they're against the idea of immigration enforcement, period. And that's
I think they're more
position.
Disingenuous than that, Mark. I mean, not every single one of them, but the ones that have set this agenda for the left and the radical left, which controls the Democratic Party, they've done it all along for some of the most, well, we've talked about this for years, some of the most evil and cynical reasons to change voter registrations, to change demographics, to bring in unvetted terrorists into our country. I mean, that's basically what they're defending. I mean, how do you conclude anything else? And sometimes I think Republicans are a little too shy to say it out loud, which is they brought terrorists into our country. After 9/11 and everything else, they didn't think it was important to vet them. Anyway, gosh, I wish we had more time, Mark. How do people find you, follow you?
My center's online at cis.org. And if you have a taste for snark and sarcasm, I'm on Twitter at Mark S, as in Stephen, Mark S. Krikorian.
Oh, I love it. We have a lot of taste for that around here. Thanks for joining us, Mark Krikorian. We'll be back with the Alan Nathan All-Stars after this.
The bright lights of Hollywood can be quite the temptation. And now, a new documentary from Prime Video reveals what happened when an aspiring actor obsessed with achieving fame committed one of the most audacious financial frauds in history. Hollywood Hustler, Glitz, Glam, Scam tells the story of Zach Horowitz, an actor who constructed an elaborate Ponzi scheme to finance his relentless pursuit of Hollywood fame. Director and executive producer Rebecca Chaiklin tells us more.
Zach was a charismatic guy whose most believable acting role turned out to be portraying a successful Hollywood mogul. He created a persona of wealth and success and managed to scam investors out of hundreds of millions to fund his lavish lifestyle, all the while trying to buy his way into an acting career. We unravel the story through those who were closest to Zach, including his ex-wife, Mallory, who later found out that their entire life was a lie when the FBI raided their home.
Don't miss Hollywood Hustler, Glitz, Glam, Scam, now streaming on Prime Video.
So there's really three factors that come into play that says exactly why mid-October is a great time to buy. So first, there's just more homes on the market this time of year. And so that means that buyers are going to have more options and more time to make their choices, and that they're going to see that sellers are more motivated to get out of the market and make a sale. Second, this is a time of year where there's less competition from other buyers. So there's just fewer buyers in the market, and that's going to mean that buyers are going to notice that, you know, there's less people to compete with. And then third, prices actually come down this time of year relative to other times of year too. So there's really a lot of savings to be had if you're a buyer who's fortunate enough to be in the market right now. And then get connected with a realtor on realtor.com. This is someone who knows your market inside and out, is going to be able to help you to guide your home search from start to finish. So for more information, you can go to realtor.com either through our app or our website. And if you really want to know more about why this is such a great time to buy, go to realtor.com/besttimetobuy.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show and the Alan Nathan All-Stars. I'm Karen Cataline, probably doing Mondays from here on out for the most part. Things are a little bit in disarray here, or not disarray, but in transition, I guess. But we're not going to abandon the tradition of calling it Alan Nathan Show or the Alan Nathan All-Stars. If you were listening over the weekend, you heard a tribute program to Alan Nathan, the whole reason for the show. And I encourage you to listen to that on the MainStreetRadioNetwork.com. I listened to it over the weekend. There were tributes. There were wonderful clips of Alan when he met his wife, Jane, many moons ago when they first met on the air. And their discussion was really, really entertaining. They mixed it up quite well, and they argued, and like all good talk show hosts do. And it's a sad time for all of us here at the Main Street Radio Network. We are expecting our next guest, whom we may or may not get. So I want to, regroup just a little bit. Talk about this upcoming mayoral race. We keep talking about it, and it's a very helpless feeling to see somebody who is an avowed Marxist, an avowed communist. There are all these names, democratic socialism. It's communism. Democratic socialism is what the Nazis were. So Democrats who have constantly accused Donald Trump and every Republican of being a Nazi, of being Hitler, which is utterly disgraceful. It's okay for them with a candidate who has a Nazi symbol. I guess it was a swastika. I didn't see it, trying to cover it up, and they cover it up. It's perfectly okay that they embrace communism now, which is what they are doing. So we are going to be talking about, it's hard not to call him anything but Kami Mamdani, and the election is soon. The biggest thing about communists is that they lie about what they really intend. They intend to take over economies. They intend to take over private property. They don't like private property. They want the government to own everything, just like the World Health Organization. You will own nothing, but you will be happy. Yeah, they're going to tell us how to feel, too. We felt enough of this, and we saw enough of this in the Otto Penn administration and the Obama administration before it, which was really, you know, three terms of Obama. So there's more to be said about this, and I will be hoping to say more about it. We have a truncated segment here with our guest who's holding on the line from Harvard University, historian and co-author of The Golden Thread, A History of Western Tradition. James Hankins joins us here on the Ellen Nathan All-Stars. Hi, James. Good to have you along.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome, welcome. So do tell us about your book and about the golden thread. What does that mean? And how is it important for our listeners today with the tumultuous times and change that we're living in right now?
Well, the golden thread is a metaphor for the Western tradition. The book is about a history of the Western tradition from the ancient Greeks and Romans down through the Middle Ages and in the modern world. And we are basically, with this book, my co-author and I, Alan Gelzo, are trying to recover the history of Western civilization, which has not been taught in our schools, either at the K-12 level or at the university level, for about 40 years. Everyone thinks it's still out there, but in fact, nobody's taught this for a long time. Now, right. I couldn't help but overhearing what you were saying about Mamdani.
Yes.
When I was logging on to your show, and one of the reasons that immediately struck me that people are signing up for this guy is because they know absolutely nothing about the Western tradition, history of communism in the 20th century.
Yes.
Let's just try a failed idea one more time, guys. You know,
yeah.
But you know, our book, of course, goes much further back, and we have a goal to try to get people to understand their past better. We have all this incredible partisanship, and we can't come up with any common definitions.
Well, but that's by design. I mean, the left that is affiliated with communism, Marxism, and so much else that took over the Democrat Party that our parents, grandparents remember, they want students to have amnesia and not know that it's not just that it's failed communism, it's that it's tyrannical and has created murder of governments of its own people. I sometimes get frustrated when people say it's failed. Well, if you're trying to create tyranny and genocide, which communism is responsible for, then it was really quite successful.
That's not something I think people who want socialism today, and I have people in my family who call themselves democratic socialists, they really have no idea what that means. They think that adding the word Democrat is gonna make socialism good, right? As though socialism has ever favored democracy.
Never.
Uh-uh. Yeah, the deeper problem for me is that nobody knows what democracy means. Nobody knows what a republic is. We are a republic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We aspire towards democracy, but we're not a democracy, we're a republic. But all of these terms have got meanings that are rooted in our past. And when you have people who are completely ignorant of of the past, you know, it's not a surprise that they can't agree on definitions. People just say democracy is what I happen to like. And
no, they don't know what they're talking about. And then they said Trump was a threat to democracy. You know what I find fascinating, James, and we have a very shortened segment, I'm sorry to say, is that you're from Harvard. You were a Harvard University historian. Did you actually teach at Harvard? Because Harvard is among the worst of the worst of communist universities, running around protesting in favor of Hamas, a terrorist organization. How did you survive there? Or did you give us a quick sketch of that? It's going to have to be very quick. I apologize.
Okay. Well, I've taught at Harvard for 40 years, and I have to say, I don't think that the whole university is corrupt. I think a lot of people just keep their head down. And the people with the biggest mouths are the ones who have the emptiest heads, and they tend to be administrators and graduate students.
Got it. How do we get your book, The Golden Thread?
It's on Amazon, deeply discounted on Amazon.
Okay. It's called The Golden Thread. The author is James Hankins, H-A-N-K-I-N-S. Thank you so much, James, for joining us. We so appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. We'll have to have you back. So we're going to take a quick break. We are well on the way in our second hour of the Alan Nathan All-Stars. Stay tuned. We'll be right back on the Main Street Radio Network.
Open enrollment season is here, and it's a great opportunity to make sure your health plan still works for your needs and budget. It's important to keep in mind that enrollment periods vary depending on how you get your health insurance. If you're on an employer plan, it usually happens between now and the end of the year. For Medicare, the annual enrollment period runs from October 15th through December the 7th. And for the health insurance marketplace, most states, it runs from November 1st through January 15th. When you're comparing plans, look beyond the monthly premiums. Check that your doctor and your prescriptions are covered. Review mental health and wellness benefits. And see if extras like dental, vision, and hearing programs are included. Digital tools and 24/7 virtual visits can also make care more convenient. And with so much misleading information online, always check the source. If something seems unclear or too good to be true, ask your doctor or your health plan before making changes. For more, visit uhcopenenrollment.com.
I first want to underscore that Hispanics may be getting the disease younger and may be more at risk, so it's important to be aware of this. Having of course, a history of a Parkinson's in the family, but having chronic constipation, whether in yourself or in your family, also chronic depression yourself or a family, then having smell loss, and also having a long-stander, what we call REM sleep behavior. That is when you act out in your dreams, you act out in your sleep, you talk in your sleep, you may sleepwalk. All these are apparently risk factors that contribute to perhaps having a greater incidence or chance of developing Parkinson's. You can go to the michaeljfox.org/PPMI to find out more so that we can make bigger strides. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan All-Stars. I'm Karen Cataline with you. Good to have you along. And we are welcoming clinical psychologist Dr. Toby Watson to the program. Don't have too much more information at the moment, but I'm happy to welcome Dr. Watson, and we'll get a little bit more information about you right now. Welcome.
Thank you, Karen. Nice to be here. Nice to talk with you. And if you'd like a little background on me, I can certainly share that with you.
I would love that. And are you the author of the article, When Pills Turn Dangerous?
I am not, but I am familiar with that article.
Okay. I apologize,
so
too. Go ahead. Tell us about
yourself.
Perfectly
okay. So I'm a clinical psychologist here in Wisconsin. I do work, concierge work nationally all over. I was one of the researchers who presented data to the FDA to get black box warning labels on certain medications that we call SSRIs, the antidepressant medications and sometimes used for anti-anxiety. Right. I've given testimony all over the world, I've helped write legislation all over the world. And so I get involved in some cases, forensic cases, when bad things happen. So sometimes somebody takes a medication, a psychotropic medication, no history of violence, and then they turn and they kill someone, you know, or they do some insanely inhumane act, and they're trying to scratch their heads of how this happened. And my area of expertise is in outcome research on psychotropic medications. So I can talk to the courts and give them this data, as well as related to like ECT and things of that nature. So drug companies don't like me. A lot of psychiatrists don't like me. Patients tend to like me a lot. Attorneys, you know, either hate me or love me. And again, I speak, you know, whatever I can based on the research. And unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there. So that's my background, in addition to doing some media production.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, we've been hearing for years that the antidepressants and psychiatric medications could actually be fueling violence. And that began around the time, I think, of Columbine in my hometown area in Colorado, when people started talking about that. And it, how do we make that connection? Because there are people who believe it absolutely. There are other people who say, well, I'll believe it when somebody comes out and says so. Is it actually true that these antipsychotics and psychiatric medications for depression and what have you are actually fueling the very violence that they were created to prevent?
Yes, unequivocally, 1,000%, without question. Anybody that's a researcher worth their salt knows this to be absolutely true, that the antidepressants, in particular the SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, absolutely increase suicidal ideation and thoughts, and also the behavior. And the FDA acknowledged it. That's why we have these black box warning labels on there. And there is an element of causality. It's not just correlational data. The FDA acknowledges that it is causal. And one of the reasons that I think we understand this is that it increases something we call akesthesia. And akesthesia, you know, is estimated between 1 to 5% for those taking SSRIs. And it's even higher for people taking antipsychotics. And it's an inner restlessness where you just feel agitated and you kind of get numb to your feelings, but you just want to crawl out of your skin. And it's a very painful kind of place to be at with the agitation and, you know, everything that goes along with that. So when you want to crawl out of your skin and you got this agitation, you've already got maybe some feelings of hopelessness or loss. And unfortunately, it even happens in the group that doesn't have that. So if you come in for, like, say, some anxiety or test-taking anxiety, and they put you on this type of medication, even in that group, you find people who ultimately try to commit suicide, commit acts of violence, and they really struggle. Sanjay Gupta, you mentioned Columbine. He acknowledged it right after Columbine. He was on CNN, came out that week, a few days or the day afterwards, and said, hey, let's not forget the antidepressant, you know, medications are known to cause this type of behavior, and they could have contributed. And when you look at, you know, there were other people, too, that had mentioned
and
it.
And nobody
as well.
Wanted to hear that, did they? A lot of people wanted to shut that conversation down. They did not want to hear it. So because our segments are so short, I want to get this question out. And that is, we all know that there are certain people and entities, organizations that want to stunt this information. And we always hear, well, it's money. The drug companies want money, 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 money. Is there a possibility that the motive is even more sinister than money, and that there are some people who actually want to encourage this kind of violent behavior because they have a political agenda? I'm thinking in terms of, and I don't even know your politics, I'm thinking in terms of things like the Fast and Furious thing, where they created the problem in order to present the solution, which generally has a lot to do with them taking more power or taking our Second Amendment rights or whatever it may be. There's an agenda there that really does not care about innocent human life at all. Have you come across this at all? Do you think it's a fallacy? What?
Absolutely. There's no question that this is politically motivated. And just for your audience and the listeners, if you go on X, Twitter, and type in The Man You Don't Know, that is a movie that I made with the Trump family, actually. So I'm the executive producer of that film, so it'll give you a little idea of my political leaning.
You know, that was even not in your bio, The Man You Don't Know.
And I just gave a talk with Charlie Kirk right before, you know, his murder 2 weeks beforehand. And was going to be doing more talks with him as well. Unfortunately, obviously, with that tragedy, it's changed now a bit. So let's get back to the question. The question is, you know, is this politically motivated? And to some extent, it is. When you look at, and again, I don't want to alienate half your audience or maybe all your audience, but when you look at more radical left ideology, and you go back many years, the things that that occurred that are major transition was one, removing, you know, fathers from inner city homes. And they did that by design, and they also incentivized that, you know, with money.
Yes.
These, you know, children that often are impoverished, often on Medicaid, Medicare, these kids disproportionately get much more medication at higher doses when they account for the diagnosis and symptom severity. So we know that they're drugging that population more than any other population. And we know that that increases, again, aggression and suicide and a whole host of general medical decline. So what you tend to find, and there's a great book called Anatomy of an Epidemic, and it highlights that you basically get more and more disabled the longer you stay on them. And it gives the neurology of why that happens. So you work your whole life kind of saving and paying into the system, and then when you're about to reap the benefits, you die 20 years prematurely, which is what the data is showing us. So I do think that there's a lot of incentivization to do this and kickbacks, and we know this happens.
Dr. Watson, because you meant you just, a variety of, you know, low-hanging fruit here, and that is in the assassination murder of Charlie Kirk. Do we know if this guy was on medication? Have you had anything to do with the investigation of that? I think he was. Was he not?
I don't have direct knowledge of this. I'm not involved in that investigation or related to that right now. And I don't have any direct knowledge, so I can't comment on, and there's too much misinformation, I think, being spread to really hone in for sure. What I can tell you, though, is that we have a profile, and the FBI has had a profile on who are these types of shooters, whether they be school shooters or, you know, political activist type shooters and things like that. And he definitely, you know, fits. I mean, when they asked, well, I shouldn't say they, when somebody asked me for that profile, I gave the profile. And I have to say that I was pretty dang right on the money. And so it would not surprise me. I would put my money on that, yes, he was taking some sort of psychiatric medication. Although, again, I have no, just based on statistics.
You know, I have a background as an MSW, and I went to Columbia, that very, very conservative school. And one could say that the social contagion and drug of trans politics and ideology is also a drug that creates depression. We were told that gender dysphoria is why we have to do mastectomies on 12-year-olds. But then, you know, most people, you didn't have to have a degree of any kind to recognize that they were creating the gender dysphoria so that they could maim children. It's terrifying. Gosh, it's such a short segment. Dr. Watson, how do people find you? And I can't wait to have you back.
Yeah, go to knowmoreaboutdrugs.org, and you can look me up there or just anywhere on Instagram. Dr. Toby Watson.
Dr. Toby Watson, thank you. Pleasure to meet you. Thank you. We'll wrap up the show of the Alan Nathan All-Stars right after this. Don't go away on the Main Street Radio Network.
Hi, I'm I'm Christina Daves. I'm a lifestyle expert with some tailgate tips for you. So my go-to drink this tailgate season is Carbless, premium cocktails in a can. They have delicious flavors like pineapple and watermelon, and it's a woman and veteran-owned business. You want to stay hydrated and healthy on game day? So these are Sierra packets. They come from the Vitamin Shop, the leading destination for lifelong wellness solutions. You have electrolytes, and then you have your greens that are organic fruits and vegetables, probiotics, and fiber, so you feel great all day. And then you want to take your drinks. You make them at home. This is an insulated flask from High Camp Flask. This is a Firefight version. It has two tumblers attached to it with a magnet, and these can be customized as well. So to get more tips like this, please go to my website at ChristinaDaves.com.
Obesity affects more than 40% of American adults, yet too often people are left without access to the support they need due to high costs, outdated one-size-fits-all treatments, or long wait times to see a specialist. Obesity medicine specialist and the head of weight loss at Hims & Hers, Dr. Craig Premack, explains.
The average wait time to see an obesity specialist in the U.S. is about 5 months. Through Hims & Hers, customers typically have their intake reviewed by a licensed provider in about 3 hours. A new analysis shows that customers accessing personalized GLP-1 treatment plans through Hims & Hers lost an average of 20 pounds, or 10% of their body weight, in 6 months. 75% of customers stayed on treatment after 6 months, far exceeding typical dropout rates. With a personalized approach and support across nutrition, movement, and mental health, and 24/7 access to a dedicated care team, the result is a comprehensive care experience that helps people succeed and build healthier lives for the long term.
To get started, visit forhers.com or hims.com.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan All-Stars. I'm Karen Cataline with you today. And we close out this show with Executive Director of the Climate Science Coalition of America and author of 4 books on energy, climate change, and sustainable development with over 100,000 copies in print. His name is Stephen Gorham, and his latest book is Green Breakdown, the Coming Renewable Energy Failure. Steve Gorham joins us right now. Glad to have you along, Steve.
Hi, Karen. Great to join you again.
Yes, good to have you. So electricity prices are rising due to all this green energy stuff they're trying to push down our throats. And Donald Trump calls it the green new scam. What do we need to know? It's excellent because you got to have that kind of thing so people understand nobody's kidding around here, that's really what it was. Now people are figuring out there've been a lot of scams that they've tried to perpetrate upon us and telling us that you're bad and evil if you disagree. That's always the red flag, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, what's going on with this lately that we need to know?
Well, I call it climatism. It's probably the biggest superstition of modern history, the idea that a trace gas can be causing dangerous global warming. Yet the world is spending over $2 trillion a year on wind and solar and some other renewables trying to control the temperature of the planet.
Yeah.
But we've also had, the One Big Beautiful Bill was passed this summer. And what it did was it slashed, passed in Congress, it slashed the subsidies for wind and solar and a bunch of other things. And so a lot of the folks on the left have been coming out saying that prices are rising because the One Big Beautiful Bill was passed. The thing is, though, that bill doesn't really take effect for another year.
That's just a little convenient fact that they've – a little inconvenient fact, kind of like Trump is demolishing the White House and he's not going to put anything back. He's just going to start demolishing the White House. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. And then if you look at where prices are rising, you find out they're primarily rising in the blue states. California, Maine, New York, Maryland, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, all in the last 5 years, their electricity prices are up 30% or more. California is up 58% in 5 years, and the U.S. average is about 22.5%, the average electricity price that has gone up, which is just about equal to inflation. But places like Georgia and Florida and Texas and Missouri that are still using a lot of natural gas and in some cases coal have prices that are rising lower than the national average. So the left is trying to say this is due to the one big beautiful bill, but if you really look at it, it's where they're in putting in these green policies.
Yeah. And you know, we don't have a lock on the media anymore. I mean, there isn't a lock against conservatives anymore on the media, but somehow that message doesn't seem to come through, does it? We still are not hearing that. I don't know why. I mean, I do, but do you feel like that people are beginning to figure it out, that they're being lied to on this?
There's some big things going on in New Jersey, for example. The two candidates have made this the biggest issue in New Jersey, the cost of electricity.
Uh-huh.
And so they're both campaigning. But New Jersey, what they did was they closed a nuclear plant, five coal plants, and two gas plants in the last 5 or 10 years. And so they have a shortage. They have a shortage of power. So I think in some places people are really learning. California is another one. You know, running your air conditioner in a medium-sized house in California costs $1,000 a month. Now, and in New England, it's also very high, Massachusetts, Connecticut. But the reason there is that the state of New York has stopped pipelines for many years going to New England. They've just said, well, we're not going to build any more pipelines. And so what they're doing is they're importing liquefied natural gas at world prices, which is very high. And so the price of gas in New England is two or three times as high as the rest of the country. And so they're feeling it as well. But, you know, this is part of the green breakdown. I think people are going to get back to sensible energy policies and away from these green ideas.
Yeah. And finally, we have a president who's not afraid to call it what it is, a scam. I do believe, you can tell me if I'm wrong, that the one among the very first executive orders that he either reversed or put into effect is to continue with the Keystone Pipeline, that the Democrats have been committed to shutting down. Every time a Democrat got in office, they shut it down. And every time a Republican got in office, which has only been Donald Trump in the last 15, 16 years, they put it back. Am I right?
I think he's trying to find a company to restart it, but I don't know that anyone has decided to do that yet. But he is negotiating with the governor of New York, whose name I'm forgetting right now, to restart two pipelines to get gas into
really?
New England.
Really? Kathy Hochul?
Kathy Hochul. Well,
the
you know,
the most
said,
leftist governor,
let
I think
you...
we've... Yeah, go ahead.
He said, we're not going to let you do any offshore wind unless you put some of these pipelines in. So he's using leverage in a number of areas. But, yeah, Mr. Trump's got it right. And you know, of course, the other big thing that I think we've talked about in the past is the artificial intelligence revolution has exploded. And we have this tremendous demand for electricity all over the country for these data centers that Meta and Microsoft, Amazon and others are building. And this is just when I present, I show this slide with a huge tidal wave, which is the I call the AI revolution, and a little tiny sailboat, which is net zero in green policies. And they're just going to get washed away by what's going on with the AI revolution.
You know, I wonder, Steve, if that's not among the reasons that the big tech people who were working against Trump avidly, like Zuckerberg and all these guys, the first thing that happened is among the first things they went down and they appeared to kiss Donald Trump's ring after he was elected around about this time a year ago.
No, he's supporter of AI.
Yeah.
And so is Chris Wright. And all these companies want to build it. They think it's the next big thing. And indeed, the number of data centers in the U.S. is up 50% in less than 2 years. So they're building these things all over the place. And you can't run these on wind and solar. You need 24-hour power. So it's a big, big change.
Well, that, you know, we have to wrap it up. What do you want to leave us with, and how do we find you?
Yeah, get a hold of Green Breakdown. They can go to my website, Steve Gorham, GOREHAM.com. I'll send them a signed copy. It's on Amazon as well. And it'll give
Excellent.
Them the real story.
Yeah. Well, keep up the great work. We so appreciate it. Well, that does it for this edition of the Alan Nathan All-Stars. We're heading into a new chapter, but always with the same Alan Nathan as our guiding star. Tune in every weekday for more on the Main Street Radio Network.
The opinions you hear on the Main Street Radio Network are those of the host, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of the station, Main Street Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Main Street Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. So please, consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about Main Street Radio Network, contact us at 703-719-0433 or at our website, mainstreetradionetwork.com.